we're stopping in the middle of discussing the symmetries of the Palatini action. And we had already described the internal rotations. Internal meaning in the internal index. And so it an infinitesimal rotation by an infinitesimal lambda changes the triad by multiplying this with the generator, which is a Levi-Civita symbol, and contracting it with your rotation parameters, lambda I. And on the connection, you get a transformation law, which is typical of a connection. So you have a derivative term. And here you have also basically something like a rotation acting on the internal index. And if you want to, you can write it as the covariant derivative acting on lambda m. Yeah, possibly, actually, I should write here this as an upper index. So this defines you how the fields, the fundamental fields, which we in the Palatini action, we take to be as independent the triad, co-triad, and the connection coefficients, how they change under rotations. And so you can see from the action that this is invariant under rotation just because you contract all indices, all internal indices. And the F tensor, we didn't discuss it, but you can show that the F, that this, the curvature, as is usually the case, if you define the curvature from a connection, that transforms as a tensor, that is, it will transform in the same way as a triad with an internal index. And if you contract these indices, these transformations cancel each other out. So that's the action. And also the action is an integral over density weight one, where the weight is, in this case, hidden in this Levi-Civita symbol. If you don't put it in the form index. And so an integral over density, the scalar density is invariant under diffeomorphisms. So the other symmetry we have is invariance under diffeomorphisms. Now by definition, the change of a field under a diffeomorphism is given by the Lie derivative. Did you discuss Lie derivatives? Okay. So that's a change on a diffeomorphism. The diffeomorphism, an infinitesimal diffeomorphism, is described by a vector field V mu. A Lie derivative acting on something with an internal index will just ignore this internal index. So the internal index doesn't do anything. We just do it by components. But the Lie derivative depends on the tensor properties of your object. So this is a covariant vector or a one form. There's no density weight. In this case, the Lie derivative of this object is given by partial derivative of your tensor. So that's coming from the fact that you evaluate your object at a new point. And then there's another term in the Lie derivative, and that comes from the fact that you have a spacetime index here, and this spacetime index also transforms. And it transforms as a partial derivative of your transformation with respect to the old coordinates. And that gives you a transformation, a derivative on the vector field. So for one forms, you have this definition of the Lie derivatives. And the connection is also one form. So you have exactly the same rule for the connection. Okay, these two symmetries are the obvious ones.
Sorry.
Oh no, I took away the action. Yeah.
Is it omega the last line or? No?
So these two are the obvious one, and now I just took away the action, which I should have kept. Interestingly, there's another translation, which is called translational symmetry or shift symmetry. And it's called a translational symmetry or shift symmetry. Because it shifts the cotriets by a covariant derivative of an internal vector. So this is a spacetime scalar. But internal vector. So the covariant derivative is defined to be as before. Partial derivative on the vector plus this connection term. And as I mentioned, you can write that as exterior derivative, as exterior covariant derivative of your internal vector. And you see that it is invariant if you do write it, for instance, in forms, then this is E veg F. And so what you have here is d omega, the variation of this action under this variation. is given by the exterior derivative adding an exterior derivative on this object N, which is then contracted with J. And all these derivatives are always defined so that you can consistently do an integration by parts, even with a covariant derivative. So here it's where you might have some boundary terms, which we happily ignore. and this. This vanishes because that's a Bianchi identity. So the action is invariant under these shifts of the field. and so we didn't need to transform at all the connection components. So these are defined to be invariant under this transformation.
Geometry, but I don't see why this is a shift. Like I don't geometrically see why we are like shifting the triad.
I don't know, maybe it's some language thing. You add something to the triad. I think if we go to the quantization and discreteness, it's really shifting some vertices in some sense. Aldo, any thoughts? No.
Sorry, I was.
Why is the shift symmetry called a shift?
What the shift symmetry is?
It's a shift.
It's called shift.
Shift. What is it shifting? So, yeah, it adds something to the It adds something to the triads, and we will see that, or co-triads, we will see that these co-triads, at least in a discretization, will give you really the edge vectors. And this symmetry adds always to a vertex, that is to all edges pointing to a vertex, or to all edge vectors pointing to a vertex, it adds one vector. So it really shifts this vector, the position of this vertex in the internal space in some sense.
In 3D, from Dimitri Simon's homework, we have shown that the tetrad is related to translations. So you have the spin connection with associated with rotations in the tangent plane. The triad in that case is associated to translations. So this is also called translation symmetry. For that reason, I think it talks to that piece.
Yeah.
And in fact, the two things that Bianchi is saying in the discrete and what I've just said are related. And so here is. It's like translation.
So we might be surprised that we have now three internal rotations and then these diffeomorphisms, which are also three. You have three components. And previously, maybe at some point, we did a counting. So here you have six gauge parameters. And in 3D gravity, or at least in the phase space formulation, you have also 6 degrees of freedom, which come from 3 metric degrees of freedom for your two-dimensional metric and 3 conjugated degrees of freedom. So these 6 parameters will completely eat up 2 degrees of freedom. So you might wonder, what is the translation symmetry doing, which adds you another 3 parameters, with nj as 3 numbers. And so in fact, it turns out that these symmetries are not independent of each other. And there's a, so you can write, for instance, a translation symmetry as a combination of the other 2. But what is actually happening, what is better is to write the diffeomorphism symmetry as a combination of the rotational symmetry and the translational symmetry. And the translational symmetry, as also Aldo was mentioning in John Simons, you basically you put everything into a bigger symmetry, which is rotations times translations. And so that has actually, it's a very simple algebra. Because it's just a rotation algebra, which has Lie algebra, structure constants, epsilon I, j, k. And the other part is even commuting, and then there's an action of the rotation acting on the translation. Compared to that, the diffeomorphisms are actually not so simple. I mean, they're simple in a covariant formalism, but we will not really discuss that they are really a pain in the canonical picture. But you can read it up. So in the canonical picture, the diffeomorphisms in 3 dimensions and higher, the algebra comes basically with structure functions. And so there are basically almost no examples where symmetries with structure functions have been quantized very successfully. So they give you always a bit of pain. But here in 3D, that's one reason why we can treat it so nicely. You can basically replace the diffeomorphism with these 2 other symmetries, translations, which will be commuting, and just the rotations. And so that will be much easier to treat. And so indeed, one can show by explicit computation, if you take all these formulas and put in things, so I will not do that because it's not extremely interesting. Well, so here I write this. So doing a certain combination of the rotation and the translation gives you a diffeomorphism with parameters v. But you get a term here, which is the torsion tensor, and which we know gives you the equation of motion, that this tensor vanishes. And so here you have v. And so here you need actually certain also descriptors or parameters. And this is defined as omega v. And omega v is defined as omega e nu, the contraction of your connection with a vector. So that gives you the descriptor for your rotation and the one for your translation is actually given by the contraction of your triad, cotriad, with a vector. So that gives you the descriptor. Anyway, the parameter for the translation. So you see here also that you need, in fact, you see one reason why you get, okay, structure functions, or you will see, if you don't see it now, you will see it. Because here you have, you use these parameters which you usually choose, many people choose to be just constant and not depend on space-time nor on phase. Nor on the configuration space. So here you choose them configuration dependent. So if you compute a commutator of these combinations, you would have also to take account if you have an action, a second action here of another symmetry transformation, you have to also symmetry transform these guys. And so you will get actually a non-trivial algebra. So and then you have the same thing. For the connection components. But here you have the other equation of motion. Namely that the curvature has to vanish. So also these, so you see that these identity, these equivalence of symmetries holds only on shell. Okay, so if you take this combination of transformation minus this transformation, it still gives you a symmetry, a non-vanishing symmetry, but this non-vanishing symmetry at some point this acts trivially on solutions. Okay. So the point here for we will see basically that we will replace the diffeomorphisms, which are quite complicated to treat in dimensions 3 and higher. With the translations plus the rotations. I mean, mostly rotations are quite easy to handle. So to some degree, translations will be replacing the diffeomorphisms. And that's, I think that's more or less what I wanted to say about symmetries. Any questions about symmetries? Okay. So I've heard you are very fond of proving that certain actions are equivalent. So you can read up on the equivalence of the Young-Mills action in first and second order formalism. And review some notation on differential forms if you want, but I will not discuss it here. Ah, it's the wrong thing. And so the next topic will be actually the canonical formalism, because well, we will see, hopefully quite soon, that all these symmetries turn out to lead to so-called constraints, and the algebra of symmetries translates into certain algebras of constraints, and so these need to be quantized, and the symmetries need to be preserved under quantization, and so on, and the main point of quantization of gravity in the canonical formalism is to deal with these constraints. And actually, then it turns out that a nice way to deal with the constraints in the canonical formalism is to go to the covariant formalism and to define a path integral, which will be a projector onto the constraints. So that will be the first part of the lecture, hopefully. But we start first with a short review of the canonical formalism. So if I bore you to death, you should let me know, because then I skip everything. So it's actually also interesting to go through the canonical formalism, because that's where we you usually try to think of a proper Hilbert space. also proper probability interpretation, probability measures, ways to integrate your fields and your wave functions. And in particular, if we go to gravity, you have a number of conceptual questions which come up in particular due to the diffeomorphic symmetry. For instance, what is time evolution? What is unitarity? What happens if you have a closed universe and so on? So it's quite useful to at least know what canonical formalism does. And it tells you, typically that's the one where you do a proper quantization so that you can really say these are the observables and these are the spectra of the observables which you can observe, which is highly non-trivial in gravity. To say what is an observable and to say what is the spectra of an observable you can observe. But to see that it's highly non-trivial, we have to discuss the canonic formalism. So we start with a review. And so you might remember in quantum mechanics, we had an action which is a functional of a trajectory of a Lagrangian, which usually depends on Q and Q dot integrated over time. And then we could do a canonical transformation. And we got the Lagrangian as PQ dot minus the Hamiltonian, where P was defined as DL PQ dot. And so to go from this expression to this expression, you need actually need to invert the function which you get here, the momenta as function of Q and Q dot, to Q dot as a function of P and Q. And if you can invert that, actually, then these Lagrangians are called regular. And if you can't invert it, the Lagrangian is called irregular. But let's for a moment assume that we can invert the Lagrangian and do the canonical analysis as you have learned. So if this is if you define P in this way, then you could introduce Poisson brackets or more fancy a symplectic structure. And so I have convention where the Poisson bracket of Q and P is equal to 1. And so for general functions, the Poisson brackets are defined as derivatives in both entries. So you get df dq this formula for the Poisson brackets. And then using this formula, you can also prove the Jacobi identity, which we at some point will need. and is an important property of a symplectic structure or a Poisson bracket. Okay, so then you want to introduce these Poisson brackets, well, mostly for quantization at some point, because you convert them into commutators, and then you can write your equation in a fancy form, your Hamiltonian equation. And these reproduce, these are equivalent to the usual Euler-Lagrange equation, which you get from varying the action. So this you can actually interpret as H generates time evolution flow. And so that also means that any f dot, because the Poisson brackets act as derivatives in both entries. So if you take f dot and f dot is a phase space function, so that means df dq q dot plus df dp p dot. So that is just the Poisson bracket of f and h. And so you can always write the solution to that. Formally, as a Taylor series in your time evolution parameter. With so-called iterated Poisson brackets, where f h r plus 1 is f h r bracket h. And FH1 is just FH. And instead of h, you can also take any other function, g. And so then you get a flow generated by g. So any phase space function can actually generate a flow on phase space. And this, these flows have special properties. They actually preserve the Poisson brackets in a certain way, and it's called symplectic flow. Okay, any questions? Anything you have not seen so often? So we will need this notion quite often, the flow generated by the Poisson brackets, and the idea that some phase space function can serve as a generator of a transformation. So the Hamiltonian acts as a generator of time evolution via the Poisson brackets on phase space. Okay, so I've understood everything, so as a homework you can do the analysis of the Palatini action. And maybe I help you a bit. So here let's write the Palatini action. So we have seen in the quantum mechanical example, and we have probably also done field theory, and you define always the momenta as depending how you see it, either a variational derivative of the action with respect to the velocities or as a partial derivative of your Lagrangian density with respect to the time derivatives of your field. So the first thing we need to do, we need actually to clarify what is time. There's a more complicated way to do that, but we choose the easier way because we have explicit coordinates. So we choose coordinates. Let me check. I just call them x. So I call them x. And so now, maybe previously I declared the indices run from 1 to 3. So now we let them run from 0, x0. I call x0 t, x1, x2, and x0 equal constant. Well, that's my constant time hypersurface. So that can, of course, look a bit wiggly. And then you can have another one. Another constant. And so at some point, we will have a notion of time evolution. But you see, it's a bit arbitrary how it can turn out to look. Yeah, I didn't really specify what all these wiggles mean in the matrix, but so the idea is that it's a bit arbitrary how we make your choices. So we will still use mu for space-time indices, and these will include 0, 1, 2. I declared x0 equal to t as a time. So I will use a, b, and so on for the spatial indices 1, 2. And so first, what to take the derivative of the Lagrangian density or the action with respect to the time derivatives, I would have to separate my time derivatives. So let's do that. It's a bit of a boring exercise. Apparently, I lose a factor of 1/2 for some reason. Oh, I forgot a factor of 1/2, we will see. here I introduced epsilon tilde AB, which is now the Levi-Civita symbol on your two-dimensional hypersurface, and can be defined. Also, these are kind of different tensor densities. You can define them as in components as epsilon tilde 0 AB. And so if you put one zero here, one of these indices to zero, you get a time derivative. And then there's another time derivative with a minus sign. And so you get rid of the factor 1/2. so the signs are eaten up by the epsilon. And so that's what you get. Hopefully, so you get here the time derivatives acting on the connection. Then okay, you have a term where the index 0 appears in the cotriad. And F is actually the anti-symmetric derivative of the connection plus a term which involves the connection itself. And so you have plus AG0. Then you have a term which apparently got by integration by parts. And a term quadratic on A, which comes from F. So here we decided, here in F you have also a spatial derivative on the connection. So that's where we do an integration by parts to put it on the cotriad. Yeah.
So the A and B are for space indices in the hypersurface, and the internal index are still given by J's.
Yeah, J runs, okay, you can decide for yourself if J runs from 0 to 2 or 1, 2, 3. But indeed, in 3D, in this 3D case, we take the full triad internal components with us. So the triad tells you a bit about the geometry of the hypersurface. It's different in 4D, but here we do that in this way. So so we have only one derivative term, which appears in F. That's this term. And there's two such terms because it's an antisymmetric derivative, and so that eats up a factor of 1/2. There's a term where you have a zero index here. And so that comes with spatial indices on F because there's an epsilon here. This comes from the spatial derivative acting on the connection, which you do an integration by parts. And AA connection epsilon. Nobody has asked me what A is. So this is just omega. I just introduce A because A is mostly used in this canonical formalism in almost all the literature. Technically, it's a pullback of your spin connection. But the pullback in our special choice of coordinates, where I just say it's x0 is equal to t, is just this in components. And so also A0, well, it's omega 0 g. So so there's one subtle thing. Previously we had Q and Q dot. And so we had a term usually to be regular. You can check if you have something linear in Q dot, your Lagrangian will never be regular. Because then you get P is something which does not depend on Q dot, so you cannot invert for Q dot. and so in fact, it's a bit subtle if you have first order action. We know that it already is a bit canonical. So in some sense, it's already in canonical form. And so to define the momenta, we will only look at 1/2 of the variables. And so here we decided to take the connection as a configuration variable. So we define momenta only with respect to the configuration variables. But we will see that this gives us a triads. Now, if you decide to also look for things conjugated to the triads, you would do an integration by parts and then find the connection. So it's kind of consistent. You just have to make sure that you get the right factors of 2 and 1/2. so we define momenta as partial derivative of the Lagrangian density, which is everything in this integral here. And so you have only this term. And so that is the two-dimensional Levi-Civita symbol contracted with your co-triad. And so again, I will use a certain symbol for the momenta, which is used in the literature throughout. And confusingly, these are called electric fluxes sometimes. So it's quite important that it's not just the co-triad or the pullback of the co-triad, but you densitize them with this epsilon. And typically, momenta are always densitized. So these are vector densities of weight 1. Okay, and then we don't find any other time derivative. So we could look, because we said A is our connection variable, we could look for the momenta conjugated to A0. So that would be the partial derivative with respect to A0 dot. We don't find an A0 dot. So this would be 0. And then we would go to another step and then find the same as we will find the way I'm doing it now. But let's first declare that, so we have found that these quantities, which are defined as the densitized cotriets, are conjugated to the connection. So our canonical Poisson brackets, and maybe have Q first, so I define it as connection, only the spatial part of the connection, conjugated to fluxes, and so that's Kronecker delta AB, Kronecker delta JK. And we are in field theory. So these are fields. So importantly, in field theory, always one of your entries, the delta function, is the density in one of your entries. Consistent with the fact that this is the density. Okay, and all other Poisson brackets vanish by definition of our symplectic structure. Okay, so what now? So we have these terms in the Lagrangian, which do not come with any time derivatives. So here we have a term which is like Q dot P. But then these terms do not come with any time derivatives. In fact, if you forget for a moment about canonical analysis and you just would write this action in these components, then you see that this variable, E0j, only appears in this term. And so if you take the variation of the action with respect to A0j, you find that FABJ is equal to 0. And in fact, we have previously found the equation of motion, which is F mu nu is equal to 0. So we find one equation, part of the equation of motion, namely that FA is a pullback of the connection, should be 0. And you might know this effect because this is the A0J is actually acting as a Lagrange multiplier. So you sometimes, if you have ever discussed variations for systems with constraints or with certain conditions, you restrict some stuff to a plane or something, then you introduce Lagrange multipliers with a constraint. Multiplied with a constraint and variation with respect to the constraints and forces use a constraint. So that's where the notion of constraint comes from. So you see the same happens for this component, and that's the reason why I did an integration by parts to write this in a nicer form. So also AJ0 just appears as linearly in the action, stands alone. So this is a Lagrange multiplier enforcing this term. And what is this term?
The torsion.
Torsion, the pullback of the torsion. So the variation with respect to E0j, you see, gives us part of the equation of motion. And the variation with respect to the time component, it's also always the time component, gives us the pullback of the torsion is zero. And so these are actually clearly part of the equation of motion. The other thing, if you think about, well, we isolated all time derivatives. So these things do not include any time derivatives. So actually constraints are equations of motion, not including so any time derivative that holds in first order formalism. First order or second time derivative, that's actually if you are second order. So meaning that here we did replace already our first derivative of the roughly of the trials that are related to the connection. So we did already replace our first order derivatives with the connection. If you would make that back, we would find first order derivatives. But the point is that usually we are used to initial values which have the fields and the first derivatives of the fields. And these can be usually freely chosen. So here we have a situation where our initial values so far given by pullbacks of the triads, of the co-triads, and pullbacks of the connection. So these are our initial values. Turns out, you can ask what happens actually with the time components. We will discuss that later. But we see that these are actually not freely choosable, but these are constraints. Meaning, if you want to evolve them, if you want to evolve these data into a consistent solution, they need to satisfy these constraints because for the simple reason that the constraints are part of the equation of motion. You can also express it in some other terms. It's a non-hyperbolic part of the equation of motions because it's not second order. These are typical for GR, but they are actually always arising if you have a gauge symmetry. So in fact, you get them always also in Young-Mills, just that you're typically not discussing them in Young-Mills. But it's the same thing in Young-Mills. And we will get the same constraint as you would get in Young-Mills. That will come from the rotation degree of freedom. And that's actually this constraint. That's the Young-Mills Gauss constraint. If you look sharply if you would have an abelian theory and replace this E with a capital E, that would be the Gauss constraint in electrodynamics. In the non-Abelian theory, you have an additional term, which is this one. And this will be the flatness constraint. So this will give us the constraints. And next time, we will discuss time evolution, because first, we have only gotten part of the equation of motion. It's an important part. But then we also need the time components of the equation of motion, which we get from the time evolution equations. But then also time evolutions we know is a gauge transformation, so we need to reconcile all these things. So we will need to do that again. Yeah, tomorrow we have another random time lecture at 11, no? Okay, any fast questions?
Is it 11:30?
11:30, even more random question. More random time. Okay, so that formula is a key formula for the lecture, for the entire lecture series. So you should understand this part.